Save big on your next project right now at Menards. From mold and mildew stains and hard-to-stick surfaces, preparing your paint project has never been easier than with Bullseye 123. Zinsser Bullseye 123 Primer is an all-purpose, high-performance, water-based primer for interior and exterior residential, commercial, and industrial applications. Save big on Bullseye 123 Primer. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Welcome back to Listen to Your Heart. I'm Jerry.
And I'm Jerry's Heart.
Today's topic, Repatha, Evolocumab. Heart, why'd you pick this one?
Well, Jerry, for people who have had a heart attack, like us, diet and exercise might not be enough to lower the risk of another one.
Okay.
To help know if we're at risk, we should be getting our LDL-C, our bad cholesterol, checked, and talking to our doctor.
I'm listening.
And if it's still too high, Repatha can be added to a statin to lower our LDL-C and our heart attack risk.
Guess it's time to ask about Repatha.
Do not take Repatha if you're allergic to it. Serious allergic reactions can occur. Get medical help right away if you have trouble breathing or swallowing, swelling of the face, lips, tongue, throat, or arms. Common side effects include runny nose, sore throat, common cold symptoms, flu or flu-like symptoms, back pain, high blood sugar, and redness, pain, or bruising at the injection site.
Listen to your heart.
Ask your doctor about Repatha. Learn more at Repatha.com or call 1-844-REPATHA.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
With patients facing long waiting times in overcrowded emergency departments, many being placed on trolleys or chairs by exhausted healthcare workers, and chaotic and distressing scenes all around, how is our accident and emergency system still in this state after all these years? Now, there is no doubt that many frontline workers are suffering from pandemic fatigue, but is that an excuse for what's happening in A&Es around the country? Well, I'm joined by Dr. Chris Luke, consultant in emergency medicine and columnist with the Irish Medical Times, and Phil Nihay, General Secretary of the INMO, the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation, and co-chair of the Emergency Department Task Force. Good morning and welcome to you both. We'll go to you, Chris. You have laboured in different A&E departments over the years. What's going on? Because, you know, there may be post-pandemic fatigue there, but many people are reporting this was like this at the time of the Celtic Tiger. Nothing has improved. If anything, matters have got worse.
Well, Pat, I suspect that is the diagnosis, that we've had a condition of perennial, what I call perma-pressure, perennial overcrowding and inundation in our emergency departments on both sides of the Irish Sea, I would emphasise, for at least a quarter of a century. And that gives you some sort of clue to the real problems. Not only that, but I despair when I hear of people talking about, for example, you know, Limerick or Letterkenny or Cork being specifically, you know, pathological. The truth, another inconvenient truth, is that this problem is now affecting all English-speaking countries and more. In fact, anywhere where the sort of Anglo-American model of the emergency room, which is a sort of a generalist unit where you just pitch up and you'll be triaged, you'll be sifted, and you'll be plugged into the system. That I think that very model is failing, and I think it's evident now from, if you look at the news headlines from Melbourne, for example, that you know, famously much vaunted, well-resourced system over there. If you look at the reports from Canada, even reports from Bordeaux, the second city, arguably the second city of France, where again famously they have this wonderfully well-resourced and, you know, the system due to high tax, they have major problems akin to ours.
So okay, but Chris, doctor's job is to diagnose. I would imagine that the HSE should be able to diagnose its own problem and fix it.
Well, there you have it. I mean, I've spent much of my 40 years at the front line lobbying for resources, you know, begging for more assistance, you know, trying to sort of inform the public debate as to why people are having to wait. Because, you know, remember this, Pat, it's a bit like being when you're a consultant in an emergency department, it's a bit like being the proprietor of a restaurant. When your clientele, when your customer, when your patients have a terrible experience, it's humiliating and is heartbreaking. So, you know, that goes on day after day, and you're sort of go blue in the face trying to tell the powers that be that these problems are perennial, and therefore, you know, a much bigger lens needs to be applied to solving the problem.
Now, I applied my personal lens recently because I ended up with my daughter, my younger daughter, in A&E last weekend, not this past one, the one before. She fell in the Aviva at the end of the concert, was not drunk or anything like that. Her mother was with her, after all, and her sister. And she was knocked out and bleeding from the back of the head. Terrifying experience for all involved. The paramedics in the Aviva, brilliant, absolutely brilliant. You know, checked her spine, got her on a sled and all that to move her into the paramedic unit. And they brought her round. She was unconscious for several minutes. They brought her round. Ambulance came. Peter and Philip, brilliant, absolutely brilliant, did all the checks and so on. And she was ferried to hospital with her mother. And that hospital was Vincent's. And there, I'm afraid, is where we were let down by the system. You know, 9 hours, 10 hours, 14 hours in total there. Was she seen? Was she checked regularly? No, she was not. Little old man in the place, not looked at all night for, you know, the entire, from the time we were there, 11:30 until the time we left, 12 hours later. It was an education for me. And the fact is that we seem to accept this is really what bothers me, that we've set our standards so low that this is acceptable. Not a word of compassion, not a word of empathy, quite the opposite from everybody there.
Well, I can only offer my sincerest sympathies to you and your daughter, because that sounds like an extraordinarily difficult and unsatisfactory, you know.
But I'm not saying we were treated anyway differently to the rest of the people. If you wanted to get medical attention, you had to knock on a door and hope someone came out, which maybe they did and maybe they didn't. A complete lack of communication with the people there. No one going around, as I would have thought, routinely checking vital signs. You know, someone who's been knocked out for several minutes and bleeding from the back of the head. You'd imagine they'd be checking from time to time. At one point, my wife said, you know, my daughter's feeling very nauseous and sick, and she was offered anti-nausea tablets. My wife, being somewhat educated in these matters, said, no, that will mask any symptoms. You know, and then another doctor agreed with her and said, oh, yeah, you don't give that anti-nausea medication when someone may have been badly concussed. So what's going on? I mean, this is not what I expected from a premier hospital.
Were I indeed trained myself? Yes. Well, I mean, it sounds, as I say, appallingly unsatisfactory. But I really would rather not focus on just one department, because I really don't know the specific details of it. But I will say this to you, Pat. Look, I think we're at the stage now with our emergency departments where we need a citizens' assembly to decide what they're for. Because they're now trying to perform, a bit like the police are trying to perform so many services to offer, you know, accommodation to the homeless, looking after the addicted, looking after minor injuries, trying to compensate for long waiting times in the surgical and outpatient clinics, trying to offer imaging for people who are waiting for months for routine scans and so forth. I mean, I could go on and on and on, but I keep coming back to this point. If you look across the Irish Sea, you'll hear tales of how people are waiting 20 hours in the back of an ambulance before they're even taken into a department like St. Vincent's. And we're talking about many, many, I mean, I heard of half a dozen departments the size of St. Vincent's just a few days ago in the UK, where routine times to get out of an ambulance was between 10 and 20 hours. So, as I say, this is a global problem. This is a systemic problem.
But
I think it will require something like a citizens' assembly to drill down into the various causes.
Fintan O'Toole wrote a piece about how, you know, we're halfway a developed country and in many other ways an underdeveloped country. And it would seem to me that in terms of our hospital service, we're on the underdeveloped, we're not, you know, third world level, but we're on the underdeveloped side of service when it comes to that. And then, of course, down in Silicon Docks, we're quite overdeveloped in many, many, many ways. But this kind of attitude that I got when my wife said, you know, we've been here 14 hours and we're waiting for the result of a scan or whatever, and someone said, oh, well, that woman over there, she's been waiting 21 hours. Now, you know, this competition for hardship, And that was from nursing staff saying, you know, someone has been waiting for 21 hours, so you're only waiting 14 hours. What kind of an attitude is that?
Well, Pat, I'll come back to what I keep saying. You know, those stories are as familiar to me now as they were 25 years ago when we had 50 patients on trolleys as far as the eye could see, you know, as when I was a young consultant. And they've been like that every week since in terms of the intervening 30 or 40 years. So as I say, the problem is that the public service is in effect imploding slowly. As I say, not just here, but wherever this model obtains. And you have the sort of classic sort of, I suppose, political issue where you have private luxury and public squalor. And that goes back to my days in UCD when we debated this, you know, back in the mid 1970s. You have this kind of tension, this creative tension, this stark contrast between the provision in terms of private lives and private businesses and the public sector. So clearly, by definition, self-evidently, we're not investing in the public sector. But people like myself and Phil have been shouting from the ramparts, literally, Pat, for decades. Literally. Yeah. And another thing is this. I mean, I've been writing periodically to the Irish Times about this situation where you have politicians who, again, discover how bad things are every few years. But as you've experienced, things can be dreadful, both for patients and for staff. And I will remind you that, you know, we're well aware that staff who have to endure these kind of conditions, and I'm asking you to please to suspend your own fury, which is entirely understandable, but just remember that the staff have been dealing with that for years. And as a result of that, we know perfectly well that staff become brutalized and become much more callous. Burnout and callousness are twins. So the more burnt out and exhausted the staff are, the less they find.
Now, Chris, I understand this because speaking to other doctors who don't work in this area, they say they wouldn't work in that area. They've gone into private medicine because they couldn't practice medicine to the standard they would like to under the conditions that prevail in this kind of system. And that's a worry because, you know, we're exporting all our young doctors and nurses off to other parts of the world, by the way, which you have pointed out have similar problems in Australia and the English-speaking world where this model is pursued. But for some reason, they enjoy it there. They can't stand it here.
Well, I think there's a very simple reason for that, Pat, is that they endure short, sometimes locum shifts, and they get paid huge amounts to do so. And it's the same for people working in Ireland in private practice. They have at least the consolation of the cash. Whereas, of course, the staff of the public sector, the frontline, the pointy end, the trenches, don't even have that kind of consolation. And as a result, there's a huge exodus of people who remember they start life as, you know, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and often enormously dedicated and hugely admirable in their aspirations. But they become ground down. And burnout is, I keep reminding people, burnout is not some weird individual failure. It may be marked by a spiritual anemia, as I call it, you know, a thinning, a wearing out of moral, spiritual nourishment. But ultimately, it's an occupational disease. So the vast majority of staff who are put into overcrowded departments and enduring conditions such as the one you've just described, they will leave because they recognize that it is the circumstances, it is the environment, it is the conditions in that environment which is making them feel so utterly miserable and therefore unable to empathize and offer the kind of compassionate care that they desire, that they really are desperate to do so, never mind the quality of service that they aspire to deliver. So, you know, it's a really vicious circle. And until some politician is brave enough to say, we need a citizens' assembly, this is completely unacceptable. And here's another thing, Pat. In addition to being toxic, in addition to being deeply unpleasant, these conditions are lethal. You know, people are actually dying by the hundreds. So, you know, the Irish Association for Emergency Medicine, led by people like Emily O'Connor and Fergal Hickey, have calculated again and again that there are likely to be hundreds of people dying in Ireland because of the overcrowded emergency department corridors, because they can't be seen. They can't be properly re-triaged like your poor daughter. Because as you yourself recognize instantly, people who are injured need to be monitored. And being seen once is not monitoring.
Yeah. Just as a quite a humorous postscript, when my daughter was seen by a doctor, her wound had to be inspected, and she said at the end of the inspection, would it be okay to have it bandaged again, because the bandage had been discarded, because it relieves some of the pressure and the pain. And the doctor bent down, picked up a bandage and a pad and handed it to my wife and said, put that on. I mean, that was the funny part of it, if you don't mind me saying so. Anyway, Phil,
well, that black humour, Pat, and I applaud your ability to smile.
Now, Phil has been listening to this. Phil, you're hoping to bring about reform, but let's talk about the practical thing first of people being burnt out. And I think Chris is probably right in stressing this is not just a 2-year burnout process. This is a burnout process that's been happening for decades.
Yeah, I think that there's a number of things that Chris has said, just that obviously we've got experience. But I think fundamentally we're dealing in Ireland with a situation where our hospitals are constantly overcrowded. It's not just EDs, it's our hospitals. So our occupancy level, for example, is over 100 all of the time, over 100%. And we know that the safe level is about 83%.
Yeah.
The difference between us and other countries, and I've worked in all countries, I've worked in the UK, I've worked in Australia, I've worked in USA as a nurse. The difference is capacity. We do not have capacity to move people from our emergency department, so they become a reservoir for everything. We don't have a sophisticated primary care, so we have no options. So we recently asked, and in my role as the task force co-chair, one of the things I asked for was an examination of who's attending and why are they attending ED. Have they seen their GP? Have they been to another facility? Like, we now have some minor injury units. And in the case of your daughter, for example, that there should be a minor injury unit. I'm not trying to...
Phil, sorry. When someone gets knocked out and is bleeding from the back of the head, if you send me to a minor injuries clinic and I happen to have a bleed on the brain, I'm in the wrong place. And I know of someone who died as a result of being ferried around two hospitals before they ended up in Beaumont, and they died because they didn't get the attention.
Absolutely. Head injuries are different. But I'm saying, in general terms, minor injuries. What I'm saying is we have to have alternatives to the ED department, because what happens is when everything is funneled into the emergency department, that's what happens. You waste for times that are just unacceptable. And we know, for example, that our wait times for injuries in the lower categories of triage are unacceptable. And we know that patients who come into these units sometimes make decisions that are really dangerous, i.e. they go home. And, you know, this happens with chest pain, it happens with injuries that really and truly we should be attending to. So we know, and one of the things that Chris said about the Citizens' Assembly, I actually think that would be a bad idea, because I think that would just delay the real issue here. The real issue here is we have a plan. We have a Sláinte Care plan that has cross-government support, but we're approaching it with an a la carte type implementation. So, for example, we should have acute hospitals in three locations in Ireland. That's the Sláinte Care plan in 2017. So we take a volume out of the acute hospital with the ED. So we have three hospitals, supposedly in planning stage, which will deal with non-urgent, non-emergency. So no ED, you just go there, you're booked in, and you have your procedure.
Yeah. Now, Phil, we're going to try and get a better line, because people are telling us they're finding it a little bit hard with the quality of the line. So I'll read out some of the texts that are coming in while we're trying to improve your line. I fully identify with your experience of the appalling service in our healthcare. We refer to nurses as angels, but they are largely responsible for the appalling services, Shane in Wexford. As usual, it'll be the nurses and junior doctors who'll take the punishment for your comments, says another. The system is the problem, not the frontline staff. Make sure to emphasise this. The A&E situation has been the same for over 20 years, whether we have COVID or are in a recession or at the height of the Celtic Tiger. It's a broken system and millions has been wasted. Nothing ever changes. had a similar experience with my elderly mother as you did, but at a different Dublin hospital. Staff were all very friendly, helpful, etc., but so overworked and burnt out. I was in A&E with my sister recently. Two people collapsed or fainted while waiting on a chair, not even a trolley. Well, that was the norm in Vincent's, I have to tell you, it was chairs. Some of them had a higher back and none of them reclined, and some of them were just kind of, yeah, you know, restaurant chairs, that kind of thing. Now, I hope Phil is back on a slightly better line. Phil, hello?
Hello, Pat. I hope that's better.
Yeah, it's a bit better, yeah. We'll continue. The question of the staff and trying to get people, like, I understand that they were under pressure. I understand that, you know, that there's a loss of empathy because they feel that they're being punished by the system, under-resourced, and so on. Is it difficult to get people, nurses, to work in A&E because of the conditions?
I think it's very difficult to get people to stay working in these conditions. And I think we have been advocating recruitment and retention measures that need to be looked at by the HSC, by government, in fact, because the COVID for the last 2 years has been extraordinary. We've been dealing with massive amounts of infection of staff themselves. So you have a lot of different wheels, I suppose, that lead to burnout. And we have surveyed our members, and the incidences of burnout are increasing. It is very serious. And as Chris said, when people recognize this themselves, or they recognize it in colleagues, what they tend to do is leave. So instead of leaving, what we want is, we want the employer to take burnout seriously. We want it to be considered as an occupational injury, which it is, and to put measures in place to reduce it. Now, the simplest measure to reduce it, obviously, is to put in place proper systems in our hospitals that deal with the volume we're constantly dealing with. So again, I get back to the point. We have a model, we have Sláintecare, we have very good recommendations within it, but we don't have an implementation plan that fast tracks those, that would relieve the pressure on our hospitals and, by extension, obviously, make life better for patients who are attending, yeah, which is what everybody wants. But I will say this, HICWA recently examined the ED in Limerick, and we had been calling on HICWA to do that. One of the reassuring points that they found was that the staff, and this is what they say, staff were observed by inspectors to be kind and caring towards patients in the emergency department and tried to respond to their individual needs, which was challenging in the context of an overcrowded and understaffed department. So that's reassuring. But also, I'm always reassured, and I'm sure Chris would say the same, When I meet student nurses, for example, they're still very enthusiastic about the profession they're entering. We want to maintain that. We want to maintain the compassion. We want to maintain the enthusiasm for providing good care. And the system is now preventing that.
But if people are dreading coming on shift, and I suspect this was possibly the case that we observed, you know, when you're coming on shift and you know you're going to be faced with loads of complaints from people who've been hours and hours and hours in A&E, it must be difficult to go to work every morning. I mean, but also there are inexplicable things. When you get someone with a leg break or whatever, and they spend the best part of a day there, and then they're told, we're not going to fix you today, we're not going to set your bone today, we'll do it maybe on Monday. You know, what kind of way is that? They should have sent them home hours earlier. Let them get a night's sleep. Why sit them in a chair to give them, you know, stupid news a day later? It does not make sense.
That's the point I was trying to make earlier, and maybe I think Chris probably would have first-hand experience of this as well. There are inappropriate attendances at EDs because there is no alternative, particularly over weekend periods. So we need to look at what services can be provided that you can access, that are staffed properly with advanced nurse practitioners, for example, that can examine, can monitor, and can provide care in an environment that's appropriate. Mm. Likewise, in the community, we must be looking at what can we do to provide services, diagnostics, for example. Why do you still have to be admitted to a hospital to get an MRI or a CT scan? Many of our members tell us that a lot of their admissions are holding a bed because they're waiting on a diagnostic test. That's ridiculous in this day and age.
All right. Now,
so we also know, for example, that recently the government have accepted the report on staffing for emergency departments, the framework, which was researched by the nursing unit in UCC. And when staffing levels are correct in these departments, which was part and parcel of measuring the outcome for patients, the incidences of patient satisfaction increase, the incidences of patients discharging themselves, going home without being seen, reduced considerably. So we know there is one immediate step. Get the staffing levels right and things improve.
All right. Chris Luke, final words from you about what needs to be done now. I mean, if it's been bad for decades, it's hard to see an overnight improvement. And if you've got loads of staff and nowhere to put the patients, what then?
Yeah, well, I had the opportunity once, Pat, of working in a private hospital in South Dublin, and I did it just to cover a friend who died, basically. And so I had an opportunity to get a glimpse of how the system worked in the private sector. And what struck me forcibly then and since is that the chief executive or the deputy chief executive visited the emergency department every single day and asked me, genuinely, honestly, is there anything he could do to help me? And that meant I got certain bits of technology, I got things like chairs, and so on and so forth. So I think that many of the problems that we are dealing with are not medical, they're not diagnostic, they're not even therapeutic, they are managerial. So we need the management of the highest seniority in the emergency departments all the time, along with people like housekeepers, to look after the creature comforts of both the staff and patients. For example, there shouldn't be any debate in 2022 about the need for chair. For people who are waiting to be seen and so on. So an awful lot of this problems could be sorted pretty quickly with senior management present on
right.
site
well,
all the time.
Lots obviously coming in on this topic, and I'll bring those comments to our listeners right throughout the programme. But Phil Nye and Chris Luke, thank you very much for joining us. By the way, speaking of management, a guy called Jeff Corbett in the Aviva was absolutely fantastic. You know, there's me on the phone and I'm getting the news that my daughter's unconscious and bleeding from the head. And this guy kept in touch, didn't know who the hell I was. I was just a dad who was worried about his daughter and he just was absolutely magnificent. So when you get great people in key positions, things do happen. So thanks to Jeff and all his paramedic staff in the Aviva.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.
Save big money on all lawn care products at Menards. Revolutionize your landscaping experience with our dig-free edging. A hassle-free solution that transforms your outdoor space effortlessly. Our innovative edging system is designed for easy setup without disrupting your lawn. Save today on all Mastermark dig-free edging at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big.